Pittsburgh Section, National Council of Jewish Women, Oral History 2, Selma Weiss and Sylvia Sachs are interviewing Albert Zecker, February 17, 1994. This is tape 3. We ended last time, you were starting your career at the Chronicle.
My part-time job.
So you had said that, you had told us how you started as a salesman, and that's where we ended.
I had worked for Reuben H. Donnelly for about 11 years when my wife informed me that I should get a job that would occupy my time 8 hours a day.
Can you talk a little slower?
Okay, fine, no problem. In 1964, one of my accounts, Joe Feldman, who was head of Feldman Connison, an advertising agency, asked if I would consider going to work in the American Jewish Press field, namely the Jewish Chronicle. And I asked him why would he insult me and ask me to go into that particular field, because the reputation of the American Jewish Press bordered on the ridiculous. They were blackmailers. They would call people up and ask them to buy an ad on the assumption that if you bought an ad, Jews would love you. No other basis. After going through a lot of negotiations with him, I agreed I would give it a year. Give it 1 year of my life. And I've been here since 30 years.
It's not bad for 1 year.
Yeah. I came into this thing realizing this is quite a change. I was in the Jewish field. I was happy about being in the Jewish field. I don't know whether I had mentioned to you, I had talked to a friend of mine, Ralph Zabarenko. Did I mention that? Who's a psychiatrist. I think you know his wife, Lucy. Ralph now dead. And I told him I was going to take this job, and he thought it was the greatest move in my life because, to quote him, I love Jews and I wasn't in love with money. So I took the job. It's been a challenge. I became very much involved in this thing. I was very lucky that I had a guy by the name of Saul Weisberg at the Federation with whom I worked. He became my mentor, and he and I worked very closely together. When I came into the Chronicle, Al Golub was the general manager, and Al Bloom was the editor. The chemistry between the two of them was like fire and water. And I was brought in to act as an intermediary between them. In fact, I would run between each office telling the other what had to be done and try to bring some kind of peace to the organization. In those days, we were lucky to put out a 20-page paper, and we had essentially the same number of people on the staff that we have today. After about 4 months, I was made the advertising manager, and I was in a constant situation of trying to get the paper out while a war was going on over my head. In 1967, it was a memorable year besides being the Six-Day War. After one of our board meetings, Al Golub had a heart attack. And it was decided that he would take it easy. Unfortunately for him, he died after a month. And I was appointed the business manager at the time. They reorganized the paper and put it on Al Bloom being the editor, and I became the business manager, and we acted as two co-equals. It was the worst of all possible situations, but it had to work. If you wanted to have a Jewish community newspaper, it had to work. Yes?
The problem between the two men, was that a personal thing, or was that was it had to do with the editing of the paper? Was it anything
personal?
It wasn't how we should do this paper.
No, Al Golub looked at Al Bloom and thought, what does he know about business? And Bloom looked at Golub and said, who are you to tell me how to run a newspaper? Because Bloom came from a long history of working in the general press. It was not a good situation. You learn from those kinds of situations where you only have one head and where you have clear line authority. The relationship with the Chronicle was compounded by our relationship with the Federation. The Chronicle was set up by the Federation through a merger of the Outlook and the Criterion, the Outlook being owned by Al Golub. That was part of the deal. He would come over here and work at the Chronicle. And the Alter family owned the Outlook, or the Criterion. The Federation agreed to pay $307,500 for nothing, because between the two of them, they had less than 3,000 circulation. They were not what you call a functioning newspaper. They were blackmailers. The Federation never made any provision for getting that money. They assumed that the Chronicle immediately would create profit. And in the 2 years before I came here, the Chronicle lost something like $100,000. So that's when I came in and we started to make money. It was a little bit of a problem. The Federation, the vehicle by which the money was given to the Federation, we won't get into that, it was through a franchise fee, it doesn't really matter. But the important thing is that the Chronicle paid its own way. The Federation did not even buy subscriptions in the early days. They told you they were buying subscriptions, but they really gave the Chronicle a minuscule amount of money for the subscriptions. I have to leave that up, if you don't mind. In essence, it came down that the Chronicle had to fund itself without any outside help. It became a rather arduous task to create money where none existed. I once composed a paper called How to Run a Jewish Paper Without Money. And I was very, very lucky in the people that I had to work with. Namely, Saul Weisberg, Beck Kaplan, who was the greatest human being I ever met in my life. Bernard Kaplan, that's Rose Kaplan's husband. Rose just recently died. There was a man who had a sense of Jewish continuity, and probably the most unsung hero in the Jewish community, mainly because he doesn't have any, he never had the kind of money that he could buy faith. He's the man who put the Federation together. He was responsible for more agencies existing. And the Chronicle became a special pet of his. Yes, I was. We had like a father-son relationship. And to give you an idea, when I took over the Chronicle in 67, I realized that a lot of the revenue that the Chronicle had on its books, which were uncollectible, were from these holiday ads. If you remember, we used to put out these massive editions, Happy New Year to all my Jewish friends from a local butcher in Punxsutawney, Pennsylvania, where maybe one Jew lived. I realized that you can't function with fake income very early. And with Beck's acquiescence, I washed out $50,000 of Chronicle revenue, just out. And we started from scratch. We put the paper on a business-like base. We started to develop demography, determine what kind of market we had here, you know, demographic concepts of what this community is. We prepared brochures, and we decided to make this paper a professional publication, or otherwise we would become a house organ. Can't be both. One of the things I take probably most pride in is that this is the only Federation operation where the board members do not contribute, have never contributed, and will never contribute to the upkeep of the Chronicle. Any other board that a person goes on, he knows, she knows, they're going to have to pay some money for that privilege. A donation to the upkeep of the organization. It does not happen here. We want people on our board who can give us help.
So that's why there's never any poor people.
Well, it isn't the money they give, because we've had people without money on the Chronicle board, but it's what they contribute to the Chronicle in the sense of their talents. We probably have more lawyers on our board, more CPAs on our board, because these are people that I meet, and I use them. And I believe that having a relationship with my laity, where it's one of equality, and where we have input, and where we can talk to each other in a frank manner. We've had some bloody battles here, and I think I may have to make this point very clear to you. The Chronicle was conceived by the Federation. It is owned by the Federation. The Federation has absolutely nothing to do with the operation of the Chronicle. And I take a lot of pride in that. And the Federation will tell you that I had a lot to do with that. Because I will not countenance people telling me what to do if they don't pay for it. So we've been pretty independent here. And this is the kind of thing that I leave as my legacy to the community. What went on at the Chronicle? We had wars on marriages, on the type of whether we would publish mixed marriage notices. It had been the policy at the Chronicle not to publish them. But with the change in the demographics in the Jewish community, people whose children we could not publish the wedding notice of started to put pressure on the Chronicle. Real pressure on our board members. And we had a famous meeting where, at my instigation, we invited rabbis from various denominations in Pittsburgh to come in, and we wanted their advice. Well, for the purpose of this history, the decision was made before the rabbis walked into the room. But we went through it. It was an interesting spectacle for me watching the rabbis in this town act without principle. Because with the exception of one rabbi, and I'll leave that for later, I never saw a greater group of mealy-mouthed individuals who were so afraid to stand up for a principle and who were begging, pleading, because recognizing, the Chronicle has problems. Wouldn't it be nice if the Chronicle could do this? Hell, they shouldn't have been talking to us like that. They should have been demanding that we stand up for something. The only person who fought us tooth and nail was a Reform rabbi. Yes, Jason Edelstein. And I take pride in that, too, because I'm the guy who brought him to Pittsburgh.
And after he was fighting for you to continue not to come.
Right. Because in his eye, if the Chronicle published a mixed marriage announcement, we were putting a hesher on it. We were saying it was legitimate. And while people would do it, it doesn't contribute to the perpetuation of Judaism. You have to have Jewish people to have Judaism. This is not a theory. After the meeting, one of my board members said, "Who the hell brought that guy into Pittsburgh?" And I was very proud to raise my hand and say, "I'm the guy who brought him into Pittsburgh." Because he gave them a real conscious session.
What about the Orthodox rabbis on
campus? No, don't be surprised, because if Miller were in town, I think Miller would have taken a strong stand. Bernard Pupko does not take strong stands except little old ladies and people who... Pupko is a great scholar. I don't go to him for anything else. He is respected in the country at large as being a real light in Jewish learning. But he did not shine, and he has not shone for me. I was against publishing mixed marriages. But as a professional, while I may articulate a point of view, I don't have a vote. And for the purpose of this history, you should be aware that my colleague at the time, Al Bloom, not being the strongest individual in the world, it was a Soviet,
I can't believe he was so strong.
Yeah, well, he was not strong, and he tried to rationalize the board's position. And my feeling at the time, and I said it to him, don't try and make yourself loved by them. I think you should be respected by the board for having a point of view. And I'm a Reformed Jew. Okay, I think the question of Kashrut in the Chronicle, our board meetings are such that people would pay to listen to the discussions that go on. The colloquies that go on there are on such a level that I should take them and sell them off. I could make a decent living. They're that good. We had a great discussion on carrying non-kosher meat in an ad. I'll never forget this as long as I live. I wanted my board to make a decision. We were carrying the Monroeville Mall supplement. At that time, A&P was out there, and they were putting ads in for pork. They love to put pork ad substance in their ads every week. And the board voted to do away with that supplement. I lost $10,000. Principle is principle. They make the decision. The board of the Chronicle makes policy. It's my job to enforce that policy. I may not like it, but I do it. That's how we function. We function very well.
You're not like the president of the United States where you can veto something.
A good professional will work with this board. He'll direct this board. He'll instruct this board. But the Chronicle board is not brought in to hear play show and tell. We don't do that. They get good news and they get bad news. I remember one year during the height of the great inflation, during the Nixon years, remember when stuff started to go, inflation was running like 15-20%, interest rates were out of, we lost money hand over fist. The post office increased their cost to us every 6 months.
When did you start charging? There was a time...
I'll tell you about that. Because we had this relationship with the Federation where they were giving us a symbol, tokenism. And I didn't mind that because, you know, if the Chronicle didn't have to take money from the Federation, fine, for subscriptions because the money was going to go elsewhere. But when the cost of publishing the Chronicle became prohibitive and their subscriptions were costing us like $35,000 a year in losses. We lost $35,000 a year every year we put out the Chronicle. This just could not go on. I told my board, we have a problem. We have a war. The war's going to come. So we went into negotiations with the Federation to make them understand they have responsibilities. If they don't want to pay for the Chronicle, let me sell the Chronicle. Well, you would think that I wanted to open up. I can't even conceive of what they thought I wanted to do, but they wouldn't let me sell subscriptions come hell or high water because they had made a commitment back in 1962 that people would get the Chronicle free if they made a $10 gift to the Federation. I mean, if every promise that was ever made was so scrupulously adhered to, the world would be a different place. But, you know, things do change. So they agreed to increase what they were paying for the Chronicle, and they never paid what they were required to pay, but we were subsidizing them, in effect, every year. It got to a point that I informed my board, either we sell subscriptions or we go out of business, because we cannot go into debt. We had no way of getting money. The only place we had it was through advertising and through subscriptions. And the normal ratio of income in a newspaper runs 85% advertising, 15% subscriptions. At that time, we were getting 3% subscription income, which didn't put a hell of a load on the advertising. The negotiations that took place there were, I call it World War I, World War II, and World War III. The first time the Federation allowed us to sell subscriptions, but without the compulsion, that if people didn't want to buy it, the Federation would continue to fight for those people. That meant if you were so inclined, you were an altruistic, the Federation would continue to fight for you. We were able to sell some subscriptions, put the pressure off us, but as soon as people found out that the Federation was buying it for their neighbor, I would lose it. We got down to what I call the Great Battle of Battles. We met with the Federation and we informed them they better be prepared to take the Quantico over lock, stock, and barrel because we cannot stay in business. They kept telling us that we could do it, you know, the old story, go out and die for dear old Siwash kind of stuff, and I told them I'm not prepared to die for dear old Siwash. Either we do it right or we don't do it. And my board was with me 100,000%. At a famous meeting with Leonard Rudolph and Leon Metzer, two of the smartest guys in the Federation, Leon Metzer is considered by some to be a ruthless, cold, calculating individual. He might be, but at least I have a rationale with him that I could use and he understood. And in the parking lot at Rodef Sholem, on a day, 5 o'clock in the afternoon, we came to an agreement. They said we could sell subscriptions, but I had to guarantee that the Federation would not lose. We went into a campaign that I consider to be a classic, and we told everybody they had to buy the Chronicle, period. I spent 3 weeks at the Federation answering telephone calls from irate givers who said a promise had been made and we were welching on our promise. And the truth of the matter is, I think that we lost something like 5 people who said they were not going to make a gift to the Federation. They made a gift. I took a lot of pride in that. A lot of selling too, but we got it. The Chronicle essentially is its own master now. Financially, this building.
What year was that?
Oh, I'd say about 8 years ago. Was it before my first heart attack or my second heart attack?
AHA.
Probably after my first heart attack. Probably about 82, 83. We bought this building. We paid for it. Federation did not put up a dime. Because of the relationship and some of the financial wheeling and dealing that went on, our balance sheet looks like we should be in bankruptcy. But it's amazing. We pay our bills in spite of a balance sheet. The Federation co-signed a guaranteed the note for our building. And they should have the luck with us, with everybody else, the luck they have with us. They've never paid a dime for us. We've never been late. Subsequently, whenever we buy something, we no longer require their guarantee. We went to 3 guys in town, and they loaned us the money. I have to bring in Casey Newman at this particular point. Casey Newman was president of the Chronicle.
That's Casey.
Lawyer.
How do you spell Casey?
Everybody knows him as C-A-S-E-Y, but it's K. Sidney Newman, but they call him Casey. Nick Lane. These guys were from...
L-A-I?
Nicholas Lane.
How do you spell
Lane? L-A-N-E. Were guys who were... Two guys were... The ones that I look to in these last years for support. Casey is a financial wizard. The only guy I know that has a computer next to his bed and does work in the middle of the night. When we were negotiating for this building, I watched him at work. He was incredible. He came up with the amortization. And we came in with this building, which is probably the best purchase in the history of the Jewish Federation. nobody protested this thing. They recognized that a transition had to take place, and I informed them very early that with my health being what it is, we better start planning for the succession of the Chronicle. 9 years ago, Barbara Befferman came to the Chronicle for a job. She started as an advertiser, B-F-F-E-R-M-A-N. She started in a lowly position as an advertising clerk. A year after she was here, I informed the board that my successor was in place and that I knew who she was. Well, let me put it to you this way. Jewish men are supposed to be enlightened and liberated and all that stuff, but they really don't believe that women can run businesses. And it took a little bit of persuasion to make them understand that this lady had more talent than anybody around. And rather than go through the unique process of a search committee and bringing in people from all over the country, I had made up my mind that she was going to get this job come hell or high water. And Nick and Casey were parties to that plan. I wouldn't call it a conspiracy, but I would call it a plan. We evolved, bringing Barbara in, promoted her gradually up the ladder. In fact, Ruth Garfinkel from your organization, the National Council?
I don't know.
She's your professional.
I don't know her. There's millions of members.
She and I once had lunch, and I told her about 6 years ago that Barbara was going to succeed me, and she reminded me of that when Barbara came into place. Barbara, about 3.5 years ago, I had another heart attack, and at that point, the prognosis for me was rather forlorn. I was informed that I would probably not live, and we decided that we weren't going to play any more games. She had to be ready for this job. And luckily, I was offered it on Boston. You have that story.
I can't see. That's never right, but I can't. This is my tape here. It's a different one, and I can't really see.
60-minute tape or a 40-minute?
It's, yeah. I, well, let's